Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm very well. How are you today?
Oh, I'm fine, thanks.
Yeah, you doing all right?
Mm-hmm.
We have a couple of humorous things to talk about. I got a phone call from a friend of mine just day before yesterday. And what he told me was he's going down to restaurant in the Borgata down in Atlantic City called Sea Blue, Michael Mina restaurant. And so he looked it up in Zagat's, where he looks up a lot of his restaurants before he goes to them. And he dialed the phone number in Zagat's. And the phone number he dialed was 1-800-MY-BORGATA, which is what he got from his particular edition from Zagat. The number that was supposed to be printed was 1-866-MY-BORGATA. The number 1-800-MY-BORGATA,
yeah,
is a sex line.
No.
Printed in Zagat's, if you try and call Sea Blue from the number in Zagat's, 1-800-MY-BORGATA, you get, it's one of those lines that says, give me your credit card number and I'll...
No, it says, give me your credit card number.
That's exactly what it says. If you want to be with slutty girls is really what it says.
Oh.
And my guess is that's not really Sea Blue wants you to hear.
Well, they've corrected it online.
What he said, what my friend Anthony said was, you know, I listened for 20 or 30 seconds because I was like, you know, maybe this is some, you know, they got some kind of cabaret show or something going on that they're advertising for. And so he listened to it for a while before he realized he clearly had the wrong number.
That's some kind of cabaret show, I'll tell you.
You really got to be careful when you put your phone, a phone number in print, that it is the right number.
Well, you know, what's fun, now we're talking about finding that restaurant. Let's talk about finding restaurants. There's this craze in New York now to have your new cocktail lounges especially. They want to be the secret place.
Mm-hmm.
Even Graydon Carter's restaurant. Graydon Carter, right. The editor of Vanity Fair, the Waverly Inn.
Mm-hmm.
No phone number published, right? And that's not about being secret. That's about being, if you're not rich and powerful, don't even call.
That's exactly.
You know, but a lot of these little cocktail bars like Milk and Honey, owned by a friend, mm-hmm. Sasha Petrasky, an unmarked door in Chinatown. Little Branch, it has a little teeny sign, another cocktail lounge, a little teeny sign on it. What's the other one in Criftogs?
Please
Don't Tell. PDT, a little restaurant that is in the back of a hot dog stand. You got to get to.
And you got to walk through a telephone booth to get there.
You got to go to the telephone booth and pick it up and ask for the hostess, and then maybe they'll let you in through the secret door. There's La Esquina, which is the restaurant inside the restaurant where you have to know to go downstairs in the back alley. Well, it turns out that Walt Disney, for all his strengths and all his faults, because he certainly was a man with a lot of faults, was way ahead on this. Mrs. Disney has always had a secret restaurant inside Disneyland in California, in Anaheim, to which only a few select people are allowed entrance. This was written about recently on a number of the blogs, and in the New Orleans section of Disneyland, behind an unmarked door, the club has 487 members. And as of the writing of the recent blog, it said a 9-year wait to get on the list. It's an 11-year wait to get on the list, and the list is closed.
And it's an 11-year wait to get in, and you can't get on the list.
Right.
So,
right.
So good try. 11 years.
But if you go, they now have a site online, which is, so, you know, it's one of those, like, we're secret, but we're not secret. We're secret, would be like everybody to know about us. Because, look, if you really wanted to be secret, you could be secret. If you really wanted to be secret, you don't have a web presence. Sasha Petrasky down who has Milk and Honey downtown, he has a very small bar, and enough people know about him that the bar is reasonably busy
all the time.
But not crazy busy, and that's not what he's going for.
They don't allow it to be crazy busy. I think that's one of the things that I'm sure this Disneyland restaurant works the same way. You can only be so busy, and if you call Milk and Honey, whether you have the phone, you know, if you happen to get the phone number, if it's too busy, they say, we're too busy, you can't come in tonight.
Well, but the other thing is it's also the seating there is not done by who's rich and famous and are you good enough to get in the list. If you're a jerk, you'll get taken off the guest list and not allowed back in. But if you know about cocktails and you get your hands on the number and you're a normal person, if they'll take your reservation if you call. And they don't even know who you are. But they want to keep it limited. What Sasha has said is, I don't want a place where you have to wait 4 months to get in. And so they'll only accept reservations that night, and only if you've got the number. But what this is about status. So there are 487 members, and you have to be a member to be able to make a reservation with a secret phone number. And then you pay $9,500 to become a member, and then you pay $3,175 after that annually. And then you have to pay full price for your meals and your drinks and all that.
And a real full price. I mean, it's an expensive restaurant.
But the thing about this is it's the rich and famous sort of way that it was where Walt Disney entertained, you know. And then it became a real statusy thing. The pictures of it, the restaurant looks beautiful. No, the restaurant looks very nice and looks very interesting, like a throwback to an old New Orleans restaurant. And the food looks good. But it's not about this is the best restaurant in the world. It's about, can you get on the list?
It's about getting on the list. Well, you know what? I don't know, because I'm not on the list.
Well,
so maybe it is the best restaurant in the world.
But you know,
but I'm not on the list, so
no,
I don't know.
That you know, that's they can't be, because if you they have pictures online and you can go find it. It's called Club 33, and I think if you could look up Disneyland Club 33 online, you'll get yourself to the website, and they'll show you pictures of the place where you can't go. but the thing is, it's not that nice, and the food does not look that nice. And but it's
It's clearly it's a nice place.
Clearly it's
meant to be a special restaurant.
And it's nice in that it's interesting. And it's certainly it's decked up. It's decked out very well, and it's sort of a piece of history. And I'm sure it's maintained very well. But it just strikes me they're not that concerned about being on the cutting edge of cuisine. There's no great chef in the kitchen making amazing food, and you know that strikes me as not what it's about.
It's certainly not a celebrity chef. We know that.
Yeah, exactly.
So there you
celebrity
go.
Chef.
So I have to just interject something. We've gone crazy. The world has gone crazy.
We're changing course here. We're
changing course in our conversation. You know, it's crazy Disneyland restaurants. Okay, phone numbers that take you to sex lines, whatever. But the craziest thing that I've encountered over the last 3 weeks of my life is the Angus beef dog food.
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, Mark,
why do we have to feed our dogs Angus beef? And why would you charge more for it?
Alpo, why would you pay more for it?
Right.
Alpo,
there you go. Why would you pay more? Forget about charging more.
Alpo has come out with a new Angus beef line. It's made with Angus beef in various flavors for their dog food. Okay, you people, dogs aren't human, and dogs will eat a rotting carcass on the
side
of the
road. Have you seen what my dog will eat? Okay, it, she doesn't care that much.
So we now have three flavors. We have prime rib flavor Alpo dog food Angus beef.
Okay, it doesn't say there's any prime rib in it. It just says prime rib flavor.
I don't know exactly what that means.
Filet mignon flavor and New York strip steak flavor. And how are they different? And I'll never know. Do you know why I'll never know?
Because you're not going to eat
Alpo dog food. Okay, it's dog food. Don't put the Angus flavored beef in the dog food and try and make more money.
No,
it's food.
It's Angus beef in the dog food, but it's probably like the shins and whatever, but it's not worth an extra penny. But the other question is prime rib flavor? Hold on a second. Prime rib is a cut. I don't know that it has a unique flavor.
Help us. We're in the handbasket, and you know where we're going.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And today we have on the show Frank Evans. He is one of the authors of a book that's just come out last October called A Field Guide to North American Truffles.
Frank Evans, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you.
Now, I think a lot of people don't realize. Now, truffles, of course, we're not talking about the chocolate truffles, right? That would be a guide to like going to chocolate stores and getting bonbons. We're talking about the tubers related to mushrooms that, when they're from Perigord in France or when they're from Alba in Italy, go for $1,000 a pound.
Up to $3,000 a pound these days.
We have truffles in North America. This is true?
Yes, this is certainly true.
But do they go for $3,000 a pound?
Well, no. Most people don't realize that there are truffles in North America. We do not have the truffles of Europe growing here except in plantations. But we certainly have native species that are appealing both for mycologists as well as for people who are interested in truffles for the table.
Now, a mycologist is one who studies mushrooms, right?
Correct.
Now, are truffles mushrooms?
Truffles are mushrooms in some loose sense of the word. They are a fruit, that is to say the spore-bearing body, of a fungus, and that's also true of mushrooms. The difference is the mushrooms grow their fruit up above the ground and drop the spores into the air or techniques like that to spread the spores around. The truffles never come above the ground. They build their spore-bearing body or their fruit underground and expect that small animals or insects or something will eat that fruit and spread the spores with that method.
Huh. Now, go ahead, Mark.
In North America, we've had a real amount of success in these mushroom farms, basically, where we cultivate mushrooms, and we're able to grow them where we want to grow them, and we have a great deal of success with that. Is it possible to have the same amount of success with truffles?
Same amount of success, I'm not sure I would use that phrase, but certainly it is possible with today's knowledge about the truffles to propagate truffles and have a commercial operation that is based on the growing of truffles.
Well,
but it won't be the same as the mushroom industry. The current mushroom industry is based on mushrooms that grow on decaying matter. That is to say, the mushroom bed is rotting material, and that's what feeds the mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
The truffles are a little different in that they have a symbiotic relationship with a tree or a shrub or some woody plant like that. And so, essentially, to grow truffles, you're really talking about planting an orchard.
That's wild. Now, what do you say it's a symbiotic relationship? And I find this is fascinating stuff to talk about. Because now, truffles are delicious food. Don't go truffling yourself unless you're a real expert or you could eat something that will kill you. So I let other people get my truffles right. You said that a truffle has a symbiotic relationship with a living tree, which is sort of fascinating. What does the truffle do for the tree, and what does the tree do for the truffle?
Well, it turns out that most of the woody plants don't have really good root systems. If you pull up a tree, go to a nursery and look at a bare root stock tree or something, you'll see that the tree grows its roots out, but they're fairly large diameter and they're kind of woody, and it doesn't subdivide deeply out into the soil. And so what the symbiotic fungus does for the tree is that it forms a relationship with the roots and essentially becomes the fine scale of the root system for the tree. So the mushroom can gather minerals and nutrients that the tree needs from a much more finely divided network as a fungus, and the tree encourages this by providing carbohydrates and other things that it's able to make through photosynthesis.
So the tree has the leaves for this thing that's fruiting underground, so it gets the energy from the sun that the truffle can't get because it's buried.
Right.
And the truffle is better able to pull nutrients out of the ground than the tree ever would be by itself.
You've got it.
And then you and I come along and disrupt that whole thing.
And eat it.
Yes.
I'm all in favor of it. Hey, here's a little science times for you. What we're talking about is when we talk about a tree's root systems not being fine enough, what happens, the way a tree or any plant pulls moisture out of the ground is the roots subdivide into smaller and smaller and smaller little tubes, basically. And if you've ever seen, like, if you put a straw in a glass of water or a soda, and the level of water in the straw is a little bit higher than the rest of the glass, that's called a capillary action, and that means that on very, very narrow tubes, and the narrower it gets, the more it exists, that the water is sort of forced up. And so you need to gather the water and the nutrients, you need to go from very, very narrow roots and into larger and larger roots that eventually carry it up the tree. But to get out of the ground in the first place, you need a very narrow root system. Did I get that right?
Yep. That's my understanding of how capillary action works and benefits trees.
And stay tuned for Mark and Francis' science show, which will be up next. But for now, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment with Frank Evans, the Field Guide to North American Troubles. You can find out where to get it at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. More interesting news about great food that grows under the ground in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then, good food handed down from the traditions of two countries, food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking with Frank Evans. He's one of the authors of The Field Guide to North American Truffles, which you can pick up and then go out in the woods with your wellies on and go dig up some truffles.
Frank, I don't understand how truffles propagate. You said that we talked earlier about insects and animals and things like that coming along to help mushrooms, but how does the truffle get from one place to the other?
Well, essentially, the truffle grows this fruiting body, this massive tissue that we call a truffle, and that's where all of the spores for the fungus are matured. It's just like an above-ground mushroom, except that the truffle is never above ground. And so this body of tissue is buried in the soil, and it contains the spores. And as those spores ripen, the truffle develops an aroma because it can't be seen, it can't be felt. How does the mouse find the truffle? Well, the truffle has evolved a way to attract the small animals to it by developing an odor that it puts out in the forest.
And it's that stink that attracts animals that also attracts us, isn't it?
Yes, we also are animals, and we also find that that's a very attractive scent, and it basically is saying, eat me.
Can I tell you that one of the interesting things about the difference between us and squirrels is that squirrels can't make risotto.
True.
And so that's one of the things, the opposing digit and the ability to make risotto and utilize truffles in that way is very important to us. So the truffle doesn't, and we're coming up on a minute left here, but the truffle, it doesn't start to smell until it's ripe and wants to be taken. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Well, and that's why we use animals to find ripe truffles, but we harvest differently in the United States, don't we?
Yes, one of the problems with the United States truffle harvest in the wild is that we have not developed the tradition of using dogs or other animals to indicate where the ripe truffle is growing. And therefore, the only technique we have is to simply rake an area down, an inch or two into the soil, and take whatever truffle is present.
And that might be, an unripe truffle, which wouldn't be as fragrant. And what I want to ask you after the news is it possible to get a ripe truffle in the United States that really smells as good if we hone our skills, or is that just never going to happen? We'll be back after the news, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
One of the most interesting ways to harvest wild food is to go mushrooming. And mushrooms are more and more an important part of the American diet. And some of our friends have mushroomed out in the field and in the forest. It's a dangerous thing, as we all know, if you've watched the old Monty Python skit about, you know, death coming to the door. But the most truffled mushrooms or mushroom-like foods are truffles. And we have truffles in North America. And we've published now, or we have published now, the first field guide to North American truffles, and Frank Evans is one of the authors. Now, Frank, how dangerous is it to go hunting for truffles? Can you really pick the wrong thing and eat something that's going to be very harmful to you?
Yes, you certainly can. If you're interested in hunting for truffles, you first probably need to become a proficient mushroom hunter, because one of the major hazards of hunting truffles would be that you might dig up an immature mushroom thinking it was a truffle, and if you eat that mushroom, it could be one of the serious poisonous mushrooms, and you would seriously regret having eaten that.
And not to mention, some truffles look like deer droppings.
Well, yes, and in my 30 years of hunting for truffles, I have mistaken balls of gum and spider egg cases and all kinds of things, thinking that they were truffles.
Did you ever make a spider egg case risotto?
I haven't gotten quite that far. I usually cut them in two so that I can see inside them before I think I'm going to use them.
See, it's that kind of experience that we need to have when we're out truffle hunting. Now, but are there types of truffles that will really make you very sick, or is it just immature mushrooms that you could come across by mistake that will make you very sick?
Well, there are a few truffles that are known to provide people with stomach upsets and serious problems. But as far as we know, there aren't any truffles that are deadly poisonous like the above-ground mushroom.
Now, there are different species of truffles, and the book is really wonderful because it's a full-color book, and it tells you, you know, where to find things, what things look like, how to tell them apart from other things. But again, I don't know that I'd just go by the book and go out on my own. I'd go with an experienced truffler, and I would, learn quite a bit about mycology before I ate anything myself that I, you know, picked up out there. But how many different species of truffles are there? And talk to us about the differences in taste. They don't all taste like the European truffles from Perigord or Alba. They have different flavors, right?
Yes, and the truffles will separate themselves fairly easily into what are called truffles and another group called false truffles. And the real truffles that we talk about are in the genus Tuber or a few selected other genuses. And the false truffles are more related to above-ground mushrooms, like we would normally get at the grocery store, and they have a very different characteristic.
Much like mining for fool's gold.
Yeah, so at any rate, worldwide there's probably anywhere from 300 to 1,000 different species of truffles. Many of the truffles of the world we haven't discovered yet because they're underground and they just don't exist in our scientific literature yet. Do know that in Oregon, we have approximately 300 different species of truffles. So I would guess that nationwide, if we really did a good survey, we'd be, you know, above 400, certainly.
Now, we talked about before the break that truffles are some of the most expensive food products you can get. And in Europe, the way that they harvest truffles, both in Italy and in France, is different from the way they're harvested in the United States or in China, in that they use trained animals to find the truffles that are emitting great smells. And when the truffles are ripe and smelly is when we want to have them. The way we harvest truffles in the United States is to rake for truffles, and then we pick up whatever truffles we find. thereby, you know, the animals only go to the ripest, smelliest truffles, which are the most valued. Now, we use truffles in the restaurant, and sometimes we've used Oregon truffles, and sometimes they've been pretty good, but they're not very expensive. And then, of course, we use in truffle season, we use the truffles of Perigord, truffles from Alba. If now, you're maybe one of the most experienced mycologists and truffle specialists out there. If they were harvested properly, if we were to use trained dogs, and if we only picked the right and the ripe truffles from Oregon, do they approach the truffles from Europe in quality?
I would certainly say yes. My experience with the Oregon truffle is that when I have nice ripe specimens, I can make delightful preparations with those truffles, every bit as valid as I would get from an Italian white truffle.
Frank, I'm going to be honest with you. I haven't had that experience with the North American truffles so far. I'm certain that I'm getting a mixture of you know, underripe and less developed truffles just because of the way we do it. But I haven't seen that shining example of the American truffle that rivals the French or the Italian yet.
Yeah, I understand that. And that's one of the challenges that we have to solve in order that we can use the North American truffles to their best advantage.
Well, and one of the things I imagine is that, Frank, when you find one of those, you don't sell them. You just go home and make risotto.
Yes, I'm not a commercial hunter for truffles.
But
there are a number of those in this area, but that's not my thing.
But the upside just seems to be so great. If you could really get great truffles, and you know, we have chefs, or even when we buy truffles, we go and smell the truffles before we buy them, and we taste it. And if they're not up to snuff, we don't, you know, they're bought
no pun intended.
They're bought on quality. I would imagine there would be a great incentive. Why don't we have trained animals here in the United States to help us find the ripe truffles? I would assume you could charge a tremendous premium.
Yeah, that is beginning to happen, and I think you're going to find that you will be offered product in the future that is at a higher price level and that will have been certified as being ready for the table. But it's a very young operation so far. I mean, it's only been the last, say, 20 years that the edibility of the North American truffles has even been investigated.
Yeah, like Francis was talking about, though, it seems so logical when truffles can cost $1,000 a pound, and like I said, in recent years we've seen some go up to even $3,000 a pound. When American truffles sell for somewhere between $50 and $100 most of the time, that there would be an economic incentive to develop that really quickly.
What are they doing now? Are there people now using dogs to harvest truffles?
Yes, increasingly we're having people who are able to train dogs use trained dogs for the gathering of the Oregon truffle. But a lot of the truffle harvest here is done by the regular mushroom harvest, the wild products harvesters who go out in the woods. And part of the problem is that the distribution network is the produce distribution network. So when it gets to New York, for instance, it came to you through the produce distribution network. And that is not a particularly knowledgeable group of people having to do with the problem of ripe truffles.
Well, now, ripe truffles have to be dealt with relatively quickly. I mean, they're a fresh product that begins to lose what makes them special. You want to talk to us about that?
Yeah, they are, you know, they're probably good for a period of time similar to regular produce, as long as they're properly handled and you don't get them hot and you don't freeze them and, you know, those kinds of things. So they are shippable. You can, you know, in today's world, ship them anywhere in the world and have perfectly good product when you get to the destination. But the problem is the purchase side of the equation. The gatherer, he just gathered some truffles in the woods. He was not using a dog, so he has a bucket full of truffles. He takes it to the produce guy. The produce guy looks at them, and he doesn't know which ones are ripe and which ones aren't, so he just buys the bucket full because he knows he can sell it because the market is so insane for truffles.
But doesn't the produce guy have a nose? I mean, you could smell them. I mean, you can tell the difference as soon as you put your nose near them.
Yeah, I agree, but I believe that is really the key piece. Is that along the distribution network, right from the guy who dug it out of the ground, all the way up to the grocer who's offering it to you, the final consumer, there's not a very high level of experience.
So there you have it. Those of you on the East, living on the East Coast with really good noses, move to the West Coast.
Well, you know, what's funny is that you know, we've been buying truffles for 15 years or so, and the truffle business has changed. It's a lot more professional than it's ever been before.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it used to be that you would get truffles like, you know, they'd fly them over on a plane. Okay, there wasn't, because, you know, you're talking about something that's very precious, and every day that it gets closer to expiring is a day that the truffle is worth less. And so it used to be you'd buy truffles from like a guy in a trench coat with like you were buying a stolen watch or something. You're like, okay, I'll meet you at 4 o'clock and we can taste the truffles, you know. And then you'd make
right.
a deal, and they often wanted cash, and it was a shady business. But it's now much more professional. But it is like things are FedEx. That's how we deal with truffles, not through, you know, coming over on a truck. Hey,
right.
Listen, Frank, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back more in just a moment and talk more about North American truffles. Frank Evans is one of the authors of The Field Guide to North American Truffles. You can find out more about that book on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Back in just a moment, 1450 WCTC. It's 1146.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work. Until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're talking today with Frank Evans, one of the authors of The Field Guide to North American Truffles. Now, truffles being an underground thing that needs to be sought out by an animal, as opposed to a mushroom, which sort of grows on decaying something above the ground. The traditional way to hunt for truffles, we talked about in Europe, using animals to find the right truffles. And now people use dogs, but historically people used to use pigs. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that's part of the mythology of truffles, certainly.
Did it actually happen, or is it just mythology?
No, it actually happened. It turns out that the pigs, particularly the sow, is designed as an animal to root around in the earth and dig up roots of things and things that grow in the ground that are good to eat, like truffles.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a natural combination. In addition, it turns out that the European black truffle is known to release a pheromone-like chemical, which is very similar, if not identical, to boar taint, which is the pheromone of the pig species. And so the sow is more than a little bit interested in finding that truffle.
So she's looking for food and sex.
Yeah, kind of.
Wow, that's one motivated pig.
Yes, indeed. And one of the problems with pigs is that you had a hard time preventing them from eating the truffle before you could get to them.
Well, because they're pigs.
Yeah.
So they rolled over to dogs because we can train a dog not to eat the truffle.
Correct.
I would imagine a dog is also easier to get into the back seat of your car.
Usually,
yeah.
Yes. There's not too many pickup trucks in Europe.
Right. And then you could, and to leash a pig, very difficult, very difficult.
So here in New Jersey, we have some great old oak trees, and I know that certain truffles have an affinity towards oak trees. We have a huge area called the Pine Barrens where we have lots and lots of pine trees. I mean, if we started digging, should we expect to find truffles here in New Jersey of one kind or another?
I would expect to find truffles in the right season in any wooded area in North America as long as there was adequate moisture.
So why do you think that people in New Jersey, for instance, aren't mushroom hunting? Or, I'm sorry, truffle hunting?
Well, it's just an unknown part of the mycological world, and encouragement, from things like the North American Field Guide should increase the knowledge of our truffles and where they grow, particularly in areas outside of Oregon where a lot of work has been done.
Okay, earlier I told all you people with really great noses to move west. Stay here.
Just look for the truffles. But, you know, I have to say, you know, we have some wonderful produce, and I hate to disparage in any way the agricultural produce of the Garden State, but be careful in New Jersey where you dig. You know, those glow-in-the-dark truffles could really...
Well, also, and who you might find.
Yeah. Oh, Lord Almighty. I have to say, I remember that...
don't want to be digging around the Meadowlands, you know?
My uncle and my grandmother used to live in a place where they used to grow tomatoes in their backyard. Mm-hmm. Turns out it was near a watch factory that had gone out of business in the 30s. But in the watch factory, they used to paint the faces of the watch with radium-infused paint, so the faces of the watch would glow in the dark.
It's great.
And they dumped a lot of that stuff in the backyard.
It was a great place for growing really big tomatoes.
And I remember that when they came around, and they had amazing tomatoes, but they came around and said, yeah, in this neighborhood, no more gardens. You don't want to eat anything that comes out of this land. So
yeah,
I'll go to...
There is a similar problem for truffles in the east as well. The pecan truffle, which is tuber leonii, it grows with pecans. And so if you go into a pecan orchard and dig it up, you have to be real careful because of the pesticides and the herbicides.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah.
The production of the pecans, because you could, in fact, get toxic levels of herbicide in your truffle.
Now where the truffles are harvested in Oregon, is that all wild place where no pesticide is used?
In Oregon, it's either wild or it's simple plantations of Douglas fir. Douglas fir is the host tree that has the Oregon white truffle under it. So much of our natural forest is Douglas fir, and most of the plantations for lumber, Weyerhaeuser and companies like that, are Douglas fir or similar species.
But
a Douglas fir doesn't need a lot of chemical manipulation to be prolific.
It's a much more natural habitat here for the Oregon truffle.
Incredible. It's wild when you find, you know, pesticides. When you put them out in the environment, they don't just go away. They turn up in unusual places. That's good advice. Hey, Frank, want to thank you for taking the time to be on the show. The book is wonderful. We'll tell people all about it. And you have happy truffle hunting.
I will. I might even go out this afternoon.
Extraordinary. I'm green with envy. The book is A Field Guide to North American Truffles. Find out about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. It's 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys.
You know, one of the most interesting parts of that show, I think, came up in that very last minute or two of the last segment with him, where he talked about certain truffles. You have to be very careful from where the truffles come because they gather, they increase the intensity of the pesticides.
I mean,
we talked about mercury in fish last week and large game fish being an issue. You know, Francis said it best, I think. These things that we put in the earth, they don't just go away.
Right, they turn up where you don't expect them to turn up. And why we think...
And turnips. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
That was awful. But they turn up where you least expect. You know, it's funny. I just think it's funny where we're supposed to wash our fruit now. And you know, if you think about that, I don't get warm and fuzzy about it. Because if I have to wash it, do I really feel that washing a living organ, whatever was on it, didn't get into the skin?
Well, hopefully, you know, you're thinking... You know, as a kid, you think, oh, it's dirty. Like, there's just dirt on it or something.
Yeah, right.
But that's not really what it is.
Because it's a living thing. Like, I spray a glass counter with some chemical, and then I wipe it off. I feel that can be cleaned. But if I spray a wooden board, wooden cutting boards are not allowed in restaurants, because wood is an organic thing. It's porous.
Mm-hmm.
And if I put something on there, we're not sure that it can come off. An apple is not made of glass. You know, an experience the other day. Jennifer came home with some grapes, and we sat down on the couch, and we were reading a couple of books, and we just started eating the grapes without washing them, which was foolish. But, Mark, I'll tell you, they tasted like hairspray. Mm-hmm. Tasted like a little bit of hairspray was on the grapes, and then we washed the grapes and we washed it away.
Did you buy them at the salon or did you buy them at
the grocery store? We bought them at the grocery store away from the hairspray aisle, but I know there was a chemical on mm-hmm. those grapes that I rinsed off the
yes,
outside.
You're sure.
But you can't tell me that whatever chemical that was did not get into the inside of
well,
the grape.
Well, almost nobody will. Almost nobody will tell you that none of it penetrates the grape. What they say is most of it is on the outside. And the other thing that, you know, a lot of people will tell you is that regular washing with just plain water won't do it.
I know, we
there
have vegetable
are all these
wash now.
Vegetable washes that you need to wash my vegetables in a vegetable wash. Shame on us.
I'll buy my strawberries from Ben Kanapaki in Monroe and just
exactly.
eat them. All right, I hope you've enjoyed the hour being with us. We've certainly enjoyed the hour being with you. I am Francis Schaaf.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.